welcome you all and thank you for being here. Michelle, Judge Michelle Lawrence is with us from Chicago. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, everybody.
How are you?
Well, great. You know, I got to
meet God. I want to hear about it. So
His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
Dalai Lama, tell us about it.
Well, it's so hard to even describe, but he is the embodiment of compassion. They MRI'd his brain at University of Wisconsin. And wherever that spot is, where it happens, he has the most well-developed of any MRI ever imaged.
And of
so
course,
it's really true.
Chicago.
I mean, he really is that kindness thing. You know, the interesting question would be, if we would have asked him, what would he think about parents who, one parent wanted to destroy each other, because he's in that situation with China.
What do you think he'd say?
Well, I know he is compassionate. He says that China has problems. And let me put it to you this way. He was speaking to a monk who was in jail for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And one monk said to him, what is your worst fear about being in jail? And he said, my worst fear is losing my compassion for my captors. So he is always, you know, you're going to be mirrored for what you do and who you need to be, whether you get it back or not. He just has to be who he is.
And he was in Chicago this past weekend, and you were very involved in that. And this is his last kind of tour. That's probably the wrong word, but last tour for him. And now what happens?
Well, we know 2012 is canceled. So his political life, he's not going to be carrying that banner anymore. Really, the person he selected to follow him is in a Chinese prison and has been for years. The Chinese have selected somebody to try and dilute the Tibetan lineage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's political, and but in ways it has a feel for what we're talking about. In
sure
ways,
does.
You know?
Compassion and caring and loving.
And aggressor and how to handle someone who's trying to destroy you. There's components of it, and it's the way you deal with these things is all the same.
Well, when I talked to you today, you were getting ready to go into the paternity call, and you said, you know, that's such a difficult task. And you know, every day you are in the trenches fighting for what is right and what is good in family court in Cook County in Chicago, Illinois. And I just have to send kudos your way for what you do and the way that you deal with families who come through your courtroom. And thank God there are families that can come through your courtroom and get the right answers and the right direction to go with their families and their children. And I'm just so proud to know you and call you my friend.
Must have seen the Dalai Lama the way you're talking.
Yeah,
you're
he was
inspired.
Here. He came to Springfield.
Thank you, Jill.
So
if it starts to catch on, that's enough for me. In
yeah,
other courtroom,
you're right.
You know, that's
you're
just,
right.
And I think that there are so many evolved judges in Cook County. That's all I could speak to.
Well, and I know you can't from the bench, you know, tout what you have done, but the great book that you have written, The Good Karma Divorce, just espouses all of your thoughts and theories, and so anybody that's listening that wants a great manifesto on how to handle what they're going through, any real compromise or conflict, not just divorce or their children in a divorce, but any kind of conflict, pick up The Good Karma Divorce because it's outstanding and you will get something out of it. So we have this wonderfully handsome man sitting
Thank
on
you.
The other line that is so incredible. Dr. Craig Childress, welcome.
Hi, Jill. Hi, Jill.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm so glad you're here again with us tonight, because I told you as we got on the line together tonight that there has been an overwhelming response to your last appearance on the show, and I think our numbers were incredible, skyrocketing for the show. Ruthie DiTucci, who owns Syndicated News with John McCune, she called me and she said, that was a fabulous show. Your numbers are out of sight. And then we put out a call for questions from some of our listeners, and we're going to respond to some of those tonight. But I want you to tell us again a little bit about you and why you're practicing in this particular arena.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, and I'm I'm glad that people are finding that information helpful. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with children and families, primarily around issues of attention deficit disorder and, you know, general angry, oppositional kinds of kids. And I was a clinical director out of an early childhood assessment and treatment center. And when I left that and entered private practice, I began to run into some of these cases of parental alienation. And for me, it's just so clear and so obvious what's going on. And then I ran into all the frustrations about other mental health professionals not understanding what's going on and undermining efforts to resolve the situation, and then the inability of the court system to recognize what's going on, primarily in my judgment, because mental health isn't clear on giving the court direction as to what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so tragic and so tragic that I took it on and said, you know what, we have to change this. We have to figure
Great.
Out a way to help these kids.
Well, I am so glad you did, because people like you are what we need. I yesterday I sat down for 5 minutes and I told Michelle this story earlier just to turn on the news to see what was on. And there happened to be a psychotherapist that I didn't know in Springfield, Illinois, talking about the weather. It's very, very hot here, as it is in most of the country, about 112 yesterday. And she was talking about how the weather affects people. And I sat there and watched her for a moment, and then I picked up the phone and got her number and called. And she happened to still be at the office. And I said, you know, hi, terrific job on the news tonight. Wanted to know how you handle parental alienation as it presents in your office. And she said, I'm not sure I really understand what those words mean. What are you talking about? Are you indicating when one parent turns the children against the other? I said, yes. And she said, I'm an alienated parent. And she said, I would love to talk to you about this, and because there's nobody really doing it in Central Illinois and very few in Illinois that you would even send anybody to. And so she's coming to a meeting that I'm having to speak, and so hopefully we've kind of drugged someone over to our side to work on this parental alienation thing. And I just, you know, I love your YouTube videos, and I can't tell you how many people have told me that they've listened to all of them and gotten so much from them. But for me, the ones that you talk about, the education of psychotherapists and how important it is for them to go on and continue education so that they can really deal with children who are going through this.
Mm-hmm. I think that's critical to solving the situation. Right now, our training of child therapists is inadequate in terms of helping them understand what's going on with the alienation process. And that fundamentally has to change. I don't think any of the other ability to solve the problem can be enacted until we have a clear mental health understanding and statement.
Absolutely.
So I think that's critical.
Michelle, do you have a comment on that?
Well, it loops back into something Dr. Childress said a few minutes ago, which is the mental health experts have to educate the judiciary. And if they aren't fully conversant with it, you know, we're usually the last resort for any alienated parent, sadly. But so we've got to really know what it is. The word parent alienation is like kryptonite in court. Many judges don't want to hear the phrase. And it's not a very loved topic for many reasons. One of them is it turns into a he said, she said. You can't tell who's telling the truth. And sometimes the alienating parent is better spoken because they're not as angry. And the angry parent, who may be in the right, doesn't come off well.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is children who are already aligned with the parent will maybe make up stories about how terrible the other parent is. You know, as judges, we like to be productive. We like to feel good about what we're doing. But these cases, it's very hard to turn around. So we don't really like them. You know?
So
but we will when we get answers. Where are we going to get answers? We're going to get answers from the mental health professionals.
Right. And from my perspective, looking at the he said, she said sort of thing is the wrong focus. Because I'm a clinical psychologist, and what shows up in my office is a child being very angry, hostile, aggressive, or overly anxious and fearful of a parent. And as I explore the issue, that parent is absolutely normal range. There's nothing wrong with the parent. And so from my focus, it's on the child's treatment. We need to resolve the child's inability to form a close relationship with a parent who is absolutely fine and everything's okay and the child could have a relationship. So it's not a matter of focusing on who's alienating, what's going on. It's a matter of resolving the child's issues. And now, from that perspective, as I move forward, I cannot resolve the child's issues until I get to the source of them. And the source of them happens to be in one parent who is supporting the child in the hostile, aggressive, the alienating parent. And so then it just begins to build out from there. But fundamentally, to me, at the core of everything is treating the child and helping the child.
But you have to... The he said, she said only doesn't matter as to content, but it only matters in terms of getting the judge's attention so that
yeah.
the judge will roll up their sleeves and start becoming proactive on behalf of the alienated parent. So that's the only reason. I'm just telling you what the stumbling blocks are for judges, the other one being the children that won't cooperate with therapy. And how do you, and I hope we can get to these, because this is just as important for the parents and the lawyers. How do you enforce these orders? I don't know if you want to talk about that now, but I certainly would like to get to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
child
why don't
won't
we
go.
Do this? Why don't, you know, a lot of the people that are listening have sent in questions to Dr. Childress, and so why don't we start with a couple of those questions and see where we go from there. And I would imagine that we're going to have some call-in questions as well. So Craig, if it's okay with you, I'm going to ask you this. Where does
sure.
the anger that these kids who are experiencing parental alienation really come from as they are in the process of alienation, and what creates such hatred and disrespect?
To understand what's going on with the child, you have to understand what the diagnosis is, what's happening here. And the diagnosis that I feel is appropriate in a great many of these cases is a shared delusional disorder. The child is absorbing the psychological meaning constructions and psychological structure of the alienating parent or the beta parent, as I refer to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the authentic child is no longer present. In my view, as a clinical psychologist, the child actually very much loves the targeted delta parent. That's just the way kids are. They are wired in their brains to love both parents. And so that's what's so aberrant about this presentation. Kids do not reject parents. That just doesn't happen. And so that says that authentic child isn't there. And so a lot of times the targeted parent is trying to talk to the child as though the child was present, and they're not. It is the alienating beta parent who is talking through the child. My metaphor for this is like along the lines of a ventriloquist and a puppet, where the ventriloquist, you know, if you're looking at a ventriloquist on stage, you will actually look at the puppet as though it's talking, or as, you know, you laugh at it and you give it the impression that it's a separate thing, but actually there's only the ventriloquist. And that's how I see this process, is that the child is in a psychologically fused state with the alienating parent and is unable to differentiate their own authentic experience from the emotions and meaning constructions that are coming through the alienating parent. And that's the real tragedy for me of this situation, is that the child is losing their authentic life. And it's important that we resolve the situation so that the child can go back to having their own life and having loving relationships with both parents, actually. And so the angry that's coming through the child is not the child's angry, and the hatred's not the hatred of the child. It's the angry and the hatred of the alienating beta parent. Where that's coming from is their own history of child abuse. And that goes back to a little something that the judge was talking about with the Dalai Lama of having compassion, is that the alienating beta parent was likely themselves abused as a child, and that's where a lot of the source stuff is coming forward. And so it's just tragedy, you know, mounting all over the place.
So I guess as an alienated parent and not the host of Family Matters, I want to ask you, where does that child go then? If that child has simply become a puppet and is mimicking what the alienator is telling them, where is that child's head then? Because if they're just making the moves and walking through, where do they go?
From my perspective, the child, I sort of emotionally see the child as deeply buried inside. And what I imagine the child saying to me is, Dr. Childress, can you please help me with this? I don't want to be doing this, but I don't have any choice in the matter. I don't know what I'm doing. Can you please help me straighten this out? And so the authentic child is, in my view, deeply buried, but it's not, the child is not present. And so what we have to do is help the child regain a sense of what is authentic to the child and what are they feeling that's being imported into them from their other parent, from the alienating parent. Now, if you understand how the mirror neuron system works, it allows us to feel what other people feel as if we were having that feeling ourselves. So we can go into a movie theater and feel what the actors feel in the movies. But when we do that, we never lose track of who we are and who the actors in the movie are. You know, we never think we are having the experiences of the actors in the movies. Even though we can begin to cry in the movies, we can begin really scared, we can experience the feelings, but we never lose our sense of separateness. The difficulty with the alienation process in the child is the child has lost the ability to differentiate their own experience from what is coming through this mirror neuron system. And so they think that they actually feel what these feelings. They think they're authentic to themselves. And so that's the delusion, that's the psychosis kind of part of this, that we need to help them differentiate and say, I know you feel this angry, but it's not really from you. I know you feel like, you know, that this is justified, that, you know, that your targeted parent, your other parent's really mean and hot. But that's not really your feelings that you're feeling. And to help them kind of get that sense of differentiation about what's authentic to them and what's coming from the other parent.
That's why when a child is involved in a case where there is alienation and the child and the alienated parent always wants me to talk to the child, my child wants to talk to you. Because it's only going to advance their interests if they are sufficiently brainwashed.
Right.
So, okay, so the children will come in and they will say, I don't ever want to see my father. I don't ever want to see him again. Could you help me? There are times when the child will attempt suicide when they think they might be forced to go see a parent.
Right.
So this is a problem, not just for the judges, but for the lawyers who are handling these cases and for the parents.
And right, and that's
the best thing. If you could tell me, and I'll let you answer it in any way you want. How, number one, I can facilitate. A lawyer can facilitate. Another parent can facilitate a child who doesn't want to be involved in therapy or see that parent.
The first thing we need to do is to make an accurate diagnosis. And one of the things we've gotten all embroiled in is whether or not parental alienation exists. And we need to get away from that and begin to be talking about not whether it exists, but how is it diagnosed and how is it treated. And so that's been the focus of my efforts here, The reason that we've gotten sidetracked, from my opinion, is because they say, well, it's not in the DSM. Well, fine, I'll go to the DSM. I'll go to the diagnostic book and make the diagnosis, which is a shared psychotic disorder, which is a shared delusional disorder. The moment I make that diagnosis, then certain other elements begin to fall into place. For example, in the DSM, under the shared psychotic disorder, it talks about the primary case as the inducer. So it's recognizing that the secondary case, which would be the child, this disorder, this state, is being induced by the primary case. And so that's where it gets away from, I don't have to worry about he said, she said, because it's assumed that the disorder rests in the primary case, which is the parent, the more dominant person in the relationship, and that they are inducing a psychotic state, a delusional disorder. And so in the DSM also says in two sentences that when you separate the secondary case, which would be the child, from the primary case, the delusions resolve. And I agree with that. If I have a shared psychotic state, I need to separate the secondary state from secondary case from the primary case, and then I can help treat and resolve the delusional disorder, the psychotic disorder. And in that regard, I'm actually working with the authenticity of the child. The true child actually loves the targeted delta parent. And so it won't take a whole bunch, because I'm working with how the brain works. I'm working with the authenticity of the child in trying to restore that. But I cannot treat the child as long as they are in this shared psychotic state with the primary case, the inducer. And so, you know, once we diagnose properly with the DSM, the DSM itself leads us to our treatment recommendations.
Can I ask, without being too literal, if I was hearing somebody present a case and saying, this is a shared psychotic state, delusional state, then I would take my pop psychology orientation and say, what part of this is psychotic? Doesn't that mean, we know it means break from reality, so is that what you mean?
It's, yes. Now, if you look at, it's a shared delusional disorder, and so the primary case has a delusion. And now if you go to the DSM on the delusional disorder, what the DSM says, it is a non-bizarre delusion, which means it involves situations that occur in everyday life. So the delusion is that the targeted parent is somehow abusive or inadequate as a parent. They're not. And that's a non-bizarre belief, but it's a false belief system that is non-responsive to contrary evidence. There's no way to change it. And the particular type of delusion is called a persecutory delusion, which is that the person or someone who is close to the person is somehow being malevolently treated, and that the delusion is that the child is somehow being mistreated by the targeted parent. And there's no way to change that belief system with the alienating parent. They believe that the targeted parent is somehow horrible and awful, and the child needs to be protected from them. The child shares that belief system that the targeted parent is somehow an horrible, awful parent that they shouldn't have a relationship with, and that's the nature of the delusional disorder. So it's a non-bizarre persecutory delusion. And now it's false. It's a false belief. I was reviewing a court judge's finding, and the judge, throughout that finding, talked about the child's distorted perception of reality, or the distorted perception of this, distorted perception. And the judge was making the accurate diagnosis. Yes, there is a distorted perception of reality in this child. Now, it's not bizarre, it's not outrageous, but it is serious. And this child is losing their authentic childhood, but also this relationship with a healthy parent. In addition, the other thing I see as part of this process with this shared psychotic state, or the shared psychological state, is that the child is expressing personality disorder dynamics. And so the child is expressing narcissistic entitlement, narcissistic rage, narcissistic loss of empathy. Okay? I'm also seeing this borderline splitting process of all good, all bad. And so I'm seeing the child manifest symptoms of a personality disorder. The child doesn't have a personality disorder. They are channeling that from the alienating parent. And so the authentic child is no longer present. We are talking to the alienating parent. Just give it up. There's no child present. There is only one person, and that person is the alienating parent. We need to get this child into treatment. We need to restore the authenticity. We need to help them understand what their own authentic experience is versus what's being channeled into them. And once we can do that, then we can then take the next step, which is restoring the child's relationship to the alienating data parent. A lot of therapy talks about reunification therapy with the targeted parent. I think that's problematic. The moment we get the diagnosis of a shared psychotic disorder, we need to remove that child from the primary case, place them over with the healthier parent, treat the child's delusion, and get the child back to the normal. There's no reason for this angry rage. There's no reason for this rejection. There's no reason for this hostility or tremendous anxiety. We need to get rid of all that stuff. Then once we're there, then we do reunification therapy with the alienating beta parent. Meanwhile, during that process, I would recommend that the alienating beta parent get into individual therapy as part of that treatment team. And we begin to treat the trauma disorder with them. That is the source origin of this whole process. We're going to talk about the source origin and the transgenerational transmission of trauma. And so, well, first we need to make the accurate diagnosis, recognize what it is, and then approach this in a comprehensive effort to treat the disorder. And in my view, we're just wasting a huge amount of time arguing about whether it exists. Yes, a shared psychotic disorder exists. So now, once you make the diagnosis, how do we go about treating and resolving the situation?
Wow, you make it sound so incredibly easy, Craig, and I hope that we can, you know, everybody listens to this, and that judges and lawyers and psychotherapists all over the country can adapt to their practices what you're saying here today, because it's so commonsensical, and it is just... So amazing.
Well, I would say, Dr. Childress, before we leave that, I just want to say, it's commonsensical, but there's the third agenda, which is the judge, who's going to be able to empower this therapy to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important piece of it. Is always going to do the balancing test, and what we need to be educated in the balancing test is the degree or the quantity of devastation from being removed to the from the parent that the child has the delusional dance with versus the benefit of the deprogramming. So what the judges have to know, and whether we like it or not, and whether if it is so clear to you that it's going to be better in the long run, because, you know, like somebody who is an alcoholic for 8 years, they lose 8 years of development, especially if they're in more teenage alcoholism. And I would imagine that a child whose brain is co-opted has lost a lot of developmental stages and how dangerous, and they probably have to re-go through them. But the judges have to be educated. The lawyers have to be educated. What's the risk? What happens to the child who is immediately removed from that environment?
And the child's going to act up and act up significantly. The issue from my perspective, and I'm a clinical psychologist, okay? I'm not a forensic psychologist. I don't, that's not what I'm doing. And from my perspective, though, it would be analogous to the idea of the child, a medical child who might need a blood transfusion and a parent is refusing the blood transfusion. And but they're not quite. Because in this case, the parent isn't refusing treatment. The other kind of combination is something that you pointed out last week, which is the Munchausen by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a different disorder. That's a factitious disorder. But it still involves a parent inducing the psychological disorder in the child. And the DSM, again, that's where I think we're looking at the words they use. They say that that primary case is, quote, the inducer. And so it's recognizing that this child is developing the psychotic disorder because of the actions of this parent. Now, if the court wants to say, well, you know what, we're just going to leave the child in the psychotic disorder and alienated from a healthy parent because the child's going to protest if we remove them, well, then that's okay. You know, if that's what you want to do. I'm a clinical psychologist. You bring a child to me, I see a serious psychotic disorder, I say it's treatable. I say DSM says the way you treat it is you separate the secondary case from the primary case, and you can treat it, you can resolve it. That's what the DSM says, that's what the treatment recommends, and the court can either go with that or they can say, well, we'll leave the child, you know, in a psychotic state with this alienating parent.
And no, so it's clear, you know, I'm not saying that, but by the same token, the judges want to just go through that process of what the acting out is going to be, what they can expect, so that they know what's going to happen and be ready for
right.
it, because it's still going to land back in our laps.
Right, and absolutely, and that's where I think, you know, we explain to them what we're looking at and the type of things we're looking at. Now, here's an interesting thing. Here's a second level down from that, though. If we can establish this process where the mental health recognizes the diagnosis and begins to make the diagnosis and begins to make the treatment recommendations, and the court begins to recognize and accept those diagnosis and treatment recommendations, then what it does is it puts the lawyer for the targeted parent in a place where they go back to the attorney for the alienating parent and say, look, if you make us, we'll have to go back to court, and this is what we're going to say. We're going to ask for separation from the child from you. What we convince your client, what we'd like to do is a more moderated treatment, something like the SBS intervention I put up on my website, whereby the visitation with the alienating parent is dependent upon the child's behavior with the targeted parent. So if the child starts to be nice and workable and cooperative with the targeted parent, then they get visitation time with the alienating parent. And what we're doing is we're putting pressure on the alienating parent to make the child behave. That is, in technical parlance, it's the phrase, the locus of stimulus control. What is the locus of stimulus control for this child's behavior? It's not in the targeted parent. The targeted parent, we could change what they're doing until the cows come home. That's not going to change the child. The locus of stimulus control that's controlling the child's behavior is the alienating parent. If we can convince them to release the child, to convince the child to be good, to convince the child they don't have to act up, then everything's fine. And so ultimately, I'd rather not separate the child from the alienating parent. I'd like for the alienating parent to stop doing it. And so what I need, though, is I need that leverage that if you continue to do this, we're going to go and treat the child. So stop doing it.
Craig,
so then we can convince them for a moderate
treatment. Like I asked you last week, how successful has that been? Have you had that encounter with an alienator and been able to positively affect a child's life by sort of threatening the alienator to induce a child to behave?
No, because this whole process has not been put into place yet.
Okay.
And so I am just now beginning to offer up this kind of report that says this is the disorder. Now, one of the issues about my practice, though, is, you know, again, I'm not a forensic psychologist, so I'm not doing court-ordered evaluations on this.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm a clinical psychologist, so I'm serving almost as a consultant to the targeted parent. And so I'm writing reports to the targeted parent that they can begin to take to other therapists and say, you know what, are you looking for the shared psychotic disorder? Are you looking for the transgenerational transmission? Are you looking for the triangulation process? For me, the issue is we need to get mental health to stand up and recognize this. Until we do, the courts can't act, the parents can't act, people can't act until mental health does its job.
So for all the lawyers listening, because we have a lot of lawyers following, What I have done is I've done a transfer of custody, stayed the order, pending how the visitation goes with the targeted parent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty good idea. It's been
yeah.
pretty effective. In one case, the boy is calling his dad. They are going for dinner, and only because of that leverage.
Right.
Because he wants to stay with mom.
Yeah. And, I prefer not to. The child is in a shared psychological state, a shared psychotic disorder with this parent. I'd rather not wrench the child out of that. My preference is for the alienating parent to release the child. But they will not do that until somebody gets control of the situation. The control dynamic is phenomenal. And so we have to get control. Once we get control and say, look, you need to stop doing this. Right now, the child's misbehavior or angry, hostile, negative, defiance, refusal, all that sort of stuff is hurting the targeted parent. It's absolutely serving the cause of the alienating parent. We have to reverse that so that it's not hurting the targeted parent, it's hurting the alienating parent. It says if we just absolutely acknowledge that it's the alienating parent who's creating the problem behavior in the child. They don't say, no, I have no control over the child. We say, well, if you have no control over the child, then we're going to have to separate you from the child until we get a handle on this. Or you can get control over your child. You can tell your child, be nice to your mom, be nice to your dad, make sure it happens. Because if you don't, we're going to go back to court and you're going to ask for separation.
So I'm sure there's a million alienated parents out there that are thinking right now, okay, you can get them to release the child. And they say, okay, I'm going to do that so I can see my child. But how do you change, ultimately, the behavior of that alienator, knowing that they're sitting back, and from my own experience, I know that my own alienator would be sitting back plotting for the next time that they could achieve their goals, and that was to hurt me or hurt that target parent through the child.
I'm going to be watching the child, okay? My client is the child. If that child is having a good relationship with the targeted parent, with the Delta parent, I'm a happy camper.
Okay?
I don't care where, I don't care how. Now, if that child starts to enter, now I don't mind about normal parent-child conflict. I want that actually. There's a certain range of conflict that I want. And so that's where the therapy process is we want to be working with real parent-child relationships. Okay? So, the child doesn't do their homework and gets punished and they're a little angry about that. That's fine. Okay? We can deal with that kind of stuff. It's the out of control, over the top. It's that narcissistic entitlement that, the lack of empathy that's just, wow, this is really serious. If I start to see that stuff, then I go back and say, stop it, to the alienating parent. You need to stop it. Now, one of the things that I would also strongly suggest is that as we look to reunification with the beta parent, because the child loves that parent too. That's just the way kids are. And so, as we work with the alienating beta parents around their own anxiety and fears and trauma history, that our goal is to ultimately reduce that anxiety in them that is triggered from their own trauma background so that they lose that focus on using that child as a weapon. We can help them move on a little bit. Let's come on, nothing to see here, let's move on. And so we've altered the meaning of what the child's hostile rejection is. It's not a way to get at the targeted parent anymore. And so they lose interest. It's no fun anymore to do that.
Well, there's a question from the chat room, not a question, really a statement. If judges have a difficult time with parental alienation, aren't they going to be really confused with shared psychotic disorder?
From my perspective,
fun how it's spelled. Well, no, not if it's broken down and it makes the kind of sense that we're talking about tonight.
That's my job. It's a mental health diagnosis. It's my job to make it. It's my job to state it. It's my job to be clear about it. And I think as long as mental health is clear, then I think, you know, the judges will have direction. And the idea here is, again, what we want to do is have that big stick as our final outcome. We don't want to rush into that, though. We want to try a more moderated approach. And I think judges would like to see that. They would like to see that we're not just running and saying, oh, separate the child immediately. We say, no, no, no. Let's try treatment for 3 to 6 months, and let's see how this is working. If it's working, great. But the criteria for working is not trying to figure out what the alienating parent is saying to the child or whether they're making visitations or right. Or, you know, I don't care about that. I'm looking at the child's symptoms. Do I have a resolution in the child's symptoms? If I get a resolution in the child's symptoms, it's working. If not, then I need to keep ratcheted up a gear because we need to treat the child disorder. Okay. And so that, from my perspective, it's a treatment issue. It's not a custody issue. I don't care what's going on between everybody else. I've got a child who's in real serious trouble.
Is that the same protocol that a judge would use if a child refuses to go to therapy? Is it saying, you know, you want to stay with this parent? If you don't go to therapy, I'm going to transfer custody in an alienation case, because that's what we're talking about.
Potentially, yeah, because that's the symptomatic. No, wait a minute. You don't have the right. You're a child, okay? That sense of narcissistic entitlement and power that you have a right to refuse a court order, are you kidding me? You don't have a right to refuse a court order. That's psychotic. That's not child. No, excuse me. You have a bedtime. You have to do your homework. You have to obey a court order.
Bravo. Bravo, Dr. Craig Childress, for saying what everybody should be saying in every courtroom all across America tonight and today and yesterday and tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
To me, it's obvious. And that's the narcissistic entitlement. That's the narcissistic self-inflation, the grandiosity that this child can not only disobey the targeted parent, they can disobey court orders. That's the runaway thing and the suicide. Are you kidding me? You're a child. Okay, you're not that strong and not that powerful.
But what are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? You're going to throw the child in jail? You can't do that.
I'm going to treat the psychotic disorder. I'm going to separate the child from the source origin of the primary psychosis. So that's my first step, is to separate the child from the primary case. Once I get the child away from that parent, then I begin to treat the false constructions of meaning that the child has this sense of entitlement. No, you're not. You're a kid. Come on, relax. Take it easy. People love you. Relax. You're a kid. Take it easy. No, that's not true. No, that's not true. Come on, relax. Take it easy. People love you. Okay? And we bring the child back into an authentic childhood like every other kid. You know, you go to school. You do what your parents tell you to do. You know, you eat your vegetables. You may not like it. You may argue about it, but you eat your vegetables. That's every other kid. Okay, and so we return the child back to their childhood. And once we do that, then we work to restore the relationship between that child and the alienating beta parent. Okay, fine. You love that parent too. Okay. And as I do that, I watch the child's symptoms. Do they come back? Or is the child able to have a good relationship with the targeted delta parent and a good relationship with the alienating beta parent? There we go. That's fine. You know, people have messed up parents all the time, and they kind of make adjustments for it and say, well, that's just dad. That's just who mom is. Okay. That's just the way it is. And so that's my goal, is to return the child back to being a child so that they can have loving relationships with both parents and we can get out of this.
Well, I want to get on to some of these questions because that we're still on our first question.
Jill, you thought that was going
to
happen.
So I'm going to go to the second one, and I'm going to ask you, Craig, what is the most effective reply a target parent can give to someone who has witnessed an alienated child's behavior toward the target parent and simply says, I don't know what to tell you, I don't want to be involved, and walks away? What do you say to that?
Well, If someone says, I don't want to be involved and walks away, then I don't think the reply is really necessary. One of the issues is, from my perspective, the people who should be treating this are psychotherapists. Okay. Unfortunately, the psychotherapeutic community isn't doing a good job of that right now. And so the targeted parent is really struggling to say, how do I change this? And so they may be looking for additional support from family or friends or coaches or teachers or other people saying, can you help me change this? Because in truth, the targeted parent is pretty powerless in changing it. There's very little they can do. In fact, almost nothing that they can do. That should be the job of the psychotherapist. That's our job. It's not the job of, you know, the grandmother. It's not the job of the teacher. It's not the job of the targeted parent. It's the job of the psychotherapist to recognize what's going on and to challenge that child and to get that child to stop doing that and to alter the construction of meaning. If you want, now it's helpful to get everybody on board as to what's happening, you know, so like the grandparents or uncles or supportive other people. So when the child does display this narcissistic entitlement or whatever, they can just kind of knock it down and say, nah, stop it. Knock it off. You know, you're a kid. You need to go to bed. Don't talk to your mom that way. That's not right. But that's about the most of it. You know, it's just to give the child a communication that that's not appropriate. It's not a good way to talk to your mom. It's not a good way to talk to your dad. Don't do that. That's silly. That's there's no reason for that. If other people are to be involved in working with the child, I would recommend that they come into the therapy session with the psychotherapist for once or twice. You know, not with the child present, but just alone with the psychotherapist, so they can talk about how to help the child. Okay, it will be just a general sort of tone to the family, general sort of tone to the thing. The real work is going to take place because of the separation and because of the work of the psychotherapist. And in those, both I would recommend both individual sessions with the child and also parent-child sessions with a targeted Delta parent. And it's that's where the real work will take place.
Well, I'm going to take it one step further, because I know there's people all across the nation that are looking for that have people that could speak into the life of an alienator and that child, and there are psychotherapists that they're looking for that are like you, and judges that they're looking for like Michelle. So. This kind of leads into the next question. If you have, how do we effectively educate people about parental alienation who may still have contact with our children without alienating them further? And what script can we suggest to these people who may be willing to reunify our children? If you don't have a terrific psychotherapist and a terrific judge, what can you do if you're just using your support system or friends that are able to speak into the lives of the alienator or the child?
Without a good psychotherapist, without this mental health stepping up and recognizing and treating, there's very little that's going to take place. And I think a lot of the parents out there who've gone through this realize that. You can go through years and years and years of ineffective psychotherapy because the therapists are not recognizing what's happening. They're taking this sort of play therapy approach or with the child, or acknowledging the child's perception, and they're taking a non-directive approach with the child or something like that. And so it's just going on and on and on. To the extent that other people can do something, it's not going to be strong enough or powerful enough as long as the child is in that relationship with the primary case. And so that's, from a treatment perspective, the moment I get the diagnosis, shared psychotic disorder, I need to separate the child from the primary case or convince the primary case to stop inducing the delusion. If I don't get either one of those, there's very little that's going to take place. Now, within that context, if I was to talk with a teacher or talk with somebody, I might just simply say, my child's caught in a divorce situation right now. It's having some struggles. Going through a difficult time. If you can add, giving some additional flexibility or support, I'd appreciate it. Let the teacher, let the coach know that the kid's having a bit of the trouble. If there's some communication problems, you know, the alienated parents jerking around with visitations at school or transfer stuff or messing with the coaches and the team and things, and you want to alert the other person that that's occurring, you might, you know, just grab them and say, look, you know, I'm having trouble communicating with my ex right now, and it might make things confusing for you at times. If you're confused or you have any trouble, here's my cell phone. Just feel free to text me to you know, get some clarity on things. And so you're just reaching out, but it's very general. And if you want somebody to help, okay, if somebody says, what can I do to help? About the most that you can do is just say, well, thank you so much for the offer here. What would be helpful is if you see my child doing something that you think is inappropriate, can you just, like, mention to them that you think that's not okay? You know, or you can do it right then, or you can wait till you see him later or something. But that's about it. Just tell him, you know what, I didn't think that was a good way to talk to your mom. What we're doing is we're challenging the construction of meaning. It's not okay. It's not okay to do these things. And that's a natural, normal social communication. But it's very light, very gentle, and then move on. Okay. That's the work should be occurring in psychotherapy. Is where it needs to take place. The other thing, you know, that's difficult, that's really, really, really hard for the targeted parent, is the alienating parent is giving all sorts of misinformation, all sorts of persecutory, horrible, they're not paying us our child support, and they're not, they're abandoning us, and they don't love us, and they're getting all this warped information from the alienating parent. And the targeted parent is in a position where if they challenge that, then they triangulate the child into the conflict. And then it makes it really hard for the psychologist or the court to decide who's doing this. Both sides are doing it now. And it's essentially tearing the child apart. If, however, the targeted parent doesn't challenge that information, then the child is only getting one half of this information, and they're going to be drawn into the alliance with the alienating parent. And from my perspective, what I see on this is it's like that old Judgment of Solomon thing where the two mothers were contesting the baby. And each one said, I'm the mother. And Solomon's judgment was, well, let's cut the baby in half and give half to each mother. The real mother, the true mother, said, no, don't kill the baby. The other person can have the child. And Solomon, in his wisdom, said, oh, that sacrifice that you made is because you're the true mother and gave the child to the true mother. Unfortunately, right now, we're not showing the wisdom of Solomon. The alienating parent is willing to destroy the child. The targeted parent isn't. And that's the problem. So the targeted parent is sacrificing their relationship with the child because they're not willing to sacrifice the child. We, mental health, court system, need to recognize that dynamic, that process, and say, wait a minute, we're not going to give the child over to the one that's willing to destroy it. We're going to give the child to the one that's willing to love it and is willing to make the sacrifice on this. And so while I recognize it's a really difficult dilemma for the targeted parent not to fight back, it's what I would recommend. And from that, mental health and the legal system then need to stand up and do our jobs, because if we don't, we're just letting the child go with the one that's willing to destroy them, willing to use them as a weapon, and that's not right.
You know, and when we hear testimony, well, one of the questions I always ask, if the lawyer isn't asking, is, you know, say something nice about what can you say is a good parenting quality? Give me a couple of them about the other parent. It's kind of a little bit the same thing. If somebody's willing to say, well, you know, she really does love them, that's one of the factors. The person who only sees the black and white and can't say anything nice, a zero-sum approach, it's going to be very detrimental for them. We have one of the questions that was called in was, what happens to the children if they don't have access to both parents? Boys without mothers, girls without mothers, and vice versa. And at what age do these kind of changes manifest themselves?
The brain and brain development, man, because I'm an early childhood person, I work a lot of neurodevelopment to the brain. The brain is what we call experience expectant and experience dependent. It expects certain experiences, and then the wiring of the brain actually depends upon certain experiences to wire up. The classic example is language. The brain expects language, and so it has pre-wired networks ready for language, but the specific language it learns, whether it's Chinese or German or English, is going to be dependent upon what language it hears. So it expects and it depends. In terms of relationships, it also expects certain relationships and then depends on the specifics of those relationships to wire up certain patterns. So the brain expects a mother role and a father role. And for a boy, the boy is going to get a sense of their own gender self-identity from that relationship with the father. And so what it means to be a man, what it means to be a father, what it means to be a husband. The girl, similarly, will get that gender self-identity from the relationship with the mother, what it means to be a woman, a wife, and a mother. In addition, the child will develop patterns for the spousal relationship based on the cross-gender relationship with the parent. So a boy will develop patterns for the wife relationship from his relationship with his own mother, the girl, the husband relationship from her patterns that she establishes with father. So those gender roles or gender relationships are important. However, in our society today, there's a lot of different family structures. We have single-parent families, we have blended families, step families, there's a wide variety, grandparents raising the kids, and the kids don't show any really systematic dysfunction based on that. And so while it's important and has influence, far more important is the quality of the relationship the child has with the caregiver. I'd like a two-parent home, nice mom and dad and stuff, but if I don't have that, we can still go a long ways if we have good quality parenting from the grandparents or the aunts or the step-parents or whoever. Now, from that perspective, when I look at the alienation process, I generally have a relatively healthy targeted parent. As I look at them, they're normal range. And I have a severely pathological, dysfunctional, alienating parent. And that's of much more concern to me, that I have a child in a long-standing, close relationship with a parent who is showing this lack of empathy for the child about what this alienating process is doing to the child, a lack of understanding about supporting the child's own relationship with the other parent, and that's a fundamental insensitivity to developmental needs of the child. And then I have this persecutory kind of thing and the victimization kind of thing, and I'm really concerned about the child in a close relationship with that. And so far more concern to me is the health of the individuals, and secondary concern would be kids need to have good relationships with both parents.
Well, Craig, we have about 40 seconds left. Unbelievably, this hour has flown by, and we didn't get to some of the questions. So if some of the people that we have Tammy and longing for her love in Texas, if you could contact me tomorrow, I'll give you Dr. Childress's answers to your questions. And we appreciate you all listening and Dr. Childress's time. And, of course, Michelle, thank you so much for
thank
being
you,
on
Jill.
Tonight. And Craig, we will have you on again if you'll do it with us, and we'll schedule a time for that. All of you can contact Dr. Craig Childress. Craig, do you want to give your contact information?
Well, they can Google me. I've got a website, and I'm in Pasadena. And, you can get me through my website and have my phone number and things up there as well.
Terrific.
Great. Thank you so much for your time and your real great wisdom. And I'm going to pass it on to my colleagues. I really thank you.
Okay. I hope it's helpful.
You're terrific. Thanks again.
Bye, everybody.
Have a great night.
Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.